This morning's message is entitled, Arise and Build. Arise and Build. You know, one of the most refreshing marks of a young person really is their idealism. The sky's the future, right? And even if you know from experience that a young person's ideals might not be always as practical, they at least are inspiring. And they also inspire faith and hope in those who may have lost their vision somewhere in the many battles of life. And there are people who've had their expectations disappointed. Maybe they had inflated expectations, and they've been disappointed. Like one jaded pastor said, originally my life's goal was a banner, silver banner, with the words, win the world for Christ. And eventually it became, win one or two. Now it's try not to lose too many. And that's unfortunate. Now, some of us probably have heard, if not all of us, have heard of Murphy's Law. Does anyone know what Murphy's Law says? What can go wrong will go wrong. Doesn't always work that way, but it's an interesting thing. For example, you're in line, and maybe at the grocery store, and one line over here is moving a little faster than your line. So what do? You hop over to the faster line. But what happens generally when you move to the faster line? Doesn't happen like this all the time. But the one that you left now begins to move faster than the one you've joined. So I see some have had that same experience. It seems to happen that way. All those papers that you've been gathering and holding on to, right? You filed them, and they've mounted to too much, and you get rid of them because you didn't think you needed them. At the moment you got rid of them, guess what happened? You needed them. That's exactly right. And then you're working on your car. And some of us guys know what that's like. You're working on your car, boom, the tool just drops down in the middle of the engine. It goes under the car, and guess where it goes under the car? In the geographical center of the car where you can barely get to it. Now, things don't always happen that way, and they make us chuckle just a little bit because some of us have had some of those types of experiences. Things don't always go smoothly in life. And even when you follow Jesus, it doesn't guarantee a trouble-free life. In fact, sometimes things are a little more difficult. But a part of growing up is to learn to deal with the world as it is, not as the world we wish it was. And this also applies in the realm of serving Jesus and serving God. It's easy for a young person or a new Christian, perhaps, even to have unrealistic expectations about serving the Lord. They say, it will be wonderful, wonderful to serve God. I'll be working with all those other saints and godly people rather than those people at work that I have to put up with. And then they get involved and things aren't always the way they thought they would be. The church isn't generally really all full of saints, and things seem to be a little disappointing for some people. Nehemiah chapter 2 helps us deal with gives us some helpful insights on the realities of serving God. And even though Nehemiah was doing God's will, it wasn't all a bed of roses. It wasn't all easy. Studying his life, Nehemiah's life, which is what we're doing, we started with chapter 1, of course, last time, and we're in chapter 2. Studying his life on one hand will help us not to be overly idealistic and thus vulnerable to disillusionment, while on the other hand, to be realistic while not giving in to cynicism or just throwing in the towel and giving up. Nehemiah faced some very real problems, but he moved through them by God's grace to accomplish some great things for God. And so I want to read chapter 2 for us so we get the context of what we're going to be studying here for these few minutes together. Nehemiah chapter 2, and we're going to read right through the entire chapter. It says, and it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad, since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. And so I became dreadfully afraid and said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? And then the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I sent him set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Then I went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. And so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, verse 12. Then I rose in the night and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and to the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down and its gates were burned with fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone and what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. And so they said, let us rise up and build. And then they set their hand to this good work. But then Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it. And they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you're doing? Will you rebel against the king? And so I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. All right. You recall the book of Nehemiah is a story about what? Building walls. It's really a story about building walls, but not only building walls, but also building up people. If you remember, the focus of the book of Nehemiah is really about spiritual leadership. And we all, in different respects, are leaders, whether you're a parent, whether you're running adventurers, or whether you're an elder of the church or a deacon. We all are a leader in our own right, maybe at the place of business, maybe at school. We're all leaders. And if someone says, well, I don't think I'm much of a leader, what can the book of Nehemiah provide for me? Well, if it is in your heart to serve the Lord, then this book also provides important instruction on the prerequisites and how to render successful service to the Lord. And if you want to know what to do when there is a problem and there doesn't seem to be a human solution to the problem, then the book of Nehemiah shows us that God will help those who work with him to find a solution. Because it deals with spiritual leadership, of course, the book of Nehemiah is particularly relevant to our time, because our time calls for spiritual leadership like no other time. We live in a time of crumbling walls, both in society and also in the church. We need people. God needs people who will shore up the foundation, who will build the walls, people who will help God's people in these last days. Can you say amen? And so the walls were down, and we asked the question the last time, why were the walls down? We're just doing a brief recap. Why were the walls down? We remember 586 BC, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar came into Jerusalem and took the flower of the youth captive, and he tore down the walls and he destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And the walls were broken down after 70 years of exile. So these exiles from Persia because at that time Persia was the leading country, the leading country at that time, took over Babylon. They left Babylon, they left Persia, and they came back to Jerusalem to build up their city. But when they came back, they faced incredible opposition. And so for 94 years prior to Nehemiah arriving, for 94 years, the walls were not built up. And you remember, he was much to blame toward the time of Nehemiah, the time of Ezra, King Artaxerxes. King Artaxerxes had done some homework and he recognized that Jerusalem in the past had been a rebellious city, so he stopped the work of building the city. And you remember that God had put a man in the presence of Artaxerxes, a man by the name of Nehemiah. He was a cupbearer, someone who worked closely with the king, someone who was a ruler to a certain extent. And so God put a man next to the problem to work out the problem. And God is looking for Nehemiahs even today. Nehemiahs of Shushan in Sacramento, perhaps even. But it wasn't Nehemiah's position, it wasn't Nehemiah's expertise, it wasn't even Nehemiah's intellect that set him apart to do God's will. This was the time of Socrates, this was the time of Plato, but these guys don't even get a mention. You see, at its root, the problem in Jerusalem, the problems were spiritual problems. And so what did God do? He raised up a spiritual man to address the spiritual problems in his church. And so we go to chapter 2, where it teaches us several things about what it takes to plan God's work. You know, when you get to the book of, when you read Nehemiah, there's so many things to learn in this book. I mean, it's so rich. Even in chapter 2, you could even, if you're a student in college and you're just about to graduate at the end of this year and you're preparing your resumes and you're going to go in for some interviews, Nehemiah chapter 2 actually gives you some tips and suggestions on how to have a successful interview, how to put together a decent resume, because Nehemiah was essentially interviewed by King Artaxerxes and he was successful in getting what he needed. And this chapter, as I mentioned, also deals with how to plan for the work so that you can work the plan, how we can be Nehemiahs in these last days. In these last days, whenever we are involved in working for God in some enterprise for Him, there are several things that we're all going to have to deal with. There's several things we're all going to have to face. So what are they? And how can we each arise to the occasion of the times in which we live? And so we look at Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 1 again, and we read these words, and it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. And if you go back to chapter 1 and verse 1, it gives us another month on the Jewish calendar, Chislu. And from the time of Chislu to Nisan was about 4-5 months, about that period of time. And during this time, or at the beginning of this time, you remember Nehemiah heard the report of what was happening in Jerusalem. He was in Shushan, he heard from his brother what was happening, and so what did Nehemiah commit himself to do? He committed himself to pray, he wept, he mourned, he fasted, he prayed for God to do something given the grievous situation down in Jerusalem. And so to be a builder of a broken wall, what do we need to do? First of all, from Chislu to Nisan, that's a time of waiting, isn't it? 4 months can be a long time. You know, the older we get, of course, time seems to go a little bit faster. But 4 months is a good long period of time. So if we're doing something for God and we're planning for His working and God is calling us to do a work for Him, which He does for each one of us, we need to learn to wait patiently on God. But someone's going to say, well, hang on, waiting patiently, waiting on God, waiting, period, that's hard. I mean, life just breezes by, life's too short to wait. But waiting is something that we all contend with on a daily basis, don't we? We wait in line at the grocery store, we go to the doctor's office and he has a waiting room, or the dentist's office, they have a waiting room. We wait for a return phone call or email or text. Our life tends to be a lot about waiting. And then, on top of that, God puts us on hold. God puts us on hold. We wait for an answer to prayer. We wait for some clear indication of His leading in our life regarding a particular situation. And aren't we also waiting for the second coming of Jesus? And so we wait. We wait. The Christian life seems to be about waiting. The psalmist, he insisted over and over again, rest in the Lord, wait patiently for Him. Another time he said, those that wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. And then he said, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and He will strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. So the Christian life is one of waiting. Serving God, we must wait patiently on the Lord. So what do? When you have to wait, you twiddle your thumbs, you read a good book. What do when you wait? Well, Nehemiah, in the story in chapter 2, Nehemiah did three things while he was waiting patiently on God. The first thing that Nehemiah did, he began with in chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, he began with praying. That's what Nehemiah began with, and he also continued his prayer. As a matter of fact, the prayer, even though it's short in chapter 1, it's not a one-shot deal. It's a summary of what Nehemiah prayed for over and over again during those 4 months of waiting for an opportunity to develop for Nehemiah to talk to King Artaxerxes. Those 4 months where he was burdened for God's glory, burdened for God's people down in Jerusalem, those things weighed upon him. And it's interesting, throughout the book of Nehemiah, you'll find there are 13 chapters in the book of Nehemiah. Out of those chapters, Nehemiah is found praying 11 times. Now, it's over a 12-year period that he's praying, but Nehemiah's life was one that was committed to praying. And many of these were just sentence prayers, but they reflect the fact that in every situation, Nehemiah looked to God in heaven for the answer to his problems and to find a solution. Here's an example of a man that Paul wrote about in 1 Thessalonians 5:17 when he said, pray without ceasing. Pray without ceasing. The Greek word translated without ceasing doesn't mean without a break, because that would be just merely impossible. It is used of a hacking cough or a repeated military assault. In other words, it means that prayer should be something that we return to again and again until something happens, until there is an answer. And you notice in chapter 2, verse 4, the king said to Nehemiah, what do you request? And so what did Nehemiah do? He said, I prayed. I prayed to the God of heaven. The king noticed in verse 2, just a few verses before, that Nehemiah was very sad in his presence. That wasn't a good thing. The king expected those that served him to be happy, for after all, they were serving him, the king, and they should be happy. But maybe there was another reason why Nehemiah was afraid, because he said, I was deathly afraid. Because if you're sad in the king's presence, and at that time, there was a lot of threats on monarchs' lives. They could just be snuffed out. Someone could poison the king's food or try to take his life some other way. And if his trusted cupbearer is sad, that may mean that Nehemiah knows something that the king doesn't know. Maybe he's holding back information. And so Nehemiah is afraid of what might happen. He's afraid because he's sad in the presence of the king. Nehemiah inadvertently let his sorrow show on his face. And the gravity of the situation is seen when he says he was deadly afraid. It was the opportunity that he'd been waiting for 4 months to be able to talk to the king. But when it actually came, he was terrified. So how did he handle it? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now, of course, that had to be a silent, instantaneous prayer. Oh, Lord, please help me. Oh, God, please give me wisdom. Something like that, right? Must have been a prayer, something to that extent. But this quick prayer rested on 4 months of extended prayer. And it shows that Nehemiah depended on God in every situation. Notice verse 8 with me. We read it earlier. And he said, this is at the bottom of verse 8, and the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. This verse shows that Nehemiah didn't attribute the king's favorable response to good luck or even to his own skill or his ability. Proverbs 21 verse 1 says, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. Hudson Taylor said, it is possible to move men through God by prayer alone. you want to move a person's heart, you hope that they would have a change of heart or mind, then pray for that person. God does amazing things. You know, one reason why God makes us wait on Him is essentially to teach us to depend on Him in prayer. If He immediately grants everything that we ask, then we're prone to just grab the goodies and run. Isn't that right? But when we wait on God in prayer, we learn to seek God Himself. We depend on Him in ways that we've never been able to lean on Him in any other way. And when the answer finally comes, we realize it is because of one reason. The good hand of God has been upon us. And then we give God the glory that He deserves, you see. And so we learn to pray during a time of waiting. Nehemiah also learned patience. During this time of waiting. Waiting reveals our impatience. Sitting in the car, traffic lights red, you're about 20 cars behind, you've got places to go. Waiting reveals our impatience, and it teaches us to be patient, at least it should. Patience is one of the fruits of the Spirit, and especially crucial for God's last day people. You remember in Revelation 14:12, here is the patience of the saints. God's last day people will be a patient people. And it's especially important in leaders, because an impatient leader can cause a lot of problems if he reacts impetuously in a crisis. So if you think about it for just a moment, Nehemiah was waiting on God in prayer in chapter 1. When he did that, it was remarkable that he did, in light of the fact that he had a natural bent towards swift, decisive action. But his waiting showed where his priorities lay. He was a man of action. There's no doubt about that. As we read this story more, we'll see that. He was a man of action, but he knew what was most important. He didn't hear about the scene in Jerusalem and immediately rush into the king's presence saying, listen, send me down there to Jerusalem. I need to fix this problem. For 4 months, he concealed his heavy burden from the king and presented it to God in heaven privately until God finally opened up the opportunity for him to talk to the king to move forward. And it's also, his patience is also seen in verse 11. Notice when he comes down to Jerusalem, it says he came down to Jerusalem and he was there how many days? He was there 3 days. Now he could have ridden down with his retinue of soldiers and announced, hey, Jerusalem, I've come to help you. I've come to help fix the problem that you're in, and I'm going to help build the wall. And I have a plan. Meet me at my house in an hour. We're going to get it done. But he didn't. He waited 3 days before doing anything, and he even moved cautiously, keeping his purposes concealed for the right time and the right moment. You know, I was a young pastor once, and sometimes a young pastor leading a church can be really bursting with great ideas and energy for reforming the church. And when they kind of press the congregation a little too hard, they're met quickly with resistance. You know, even in witnessing, some of us are over here and God's still here with working with the person. We've run ahead of him and he's not there. He's back here. We need to remember about the effects of sowing and reaping. We've heard about that here recently in the last few weeks. Sowing and reaping, it takes time to sow. But when you sow a field, you're gonna what? You're gonna end up seeing things grow and things can be reaped. It just takes time to sow, and it takes time for things to grow in order for them to be reaped. Nehemiah prayed and he was patient as God worked on people's hearts. So Nehemiah prayed, he was learning patience while he was waiting patiently on God, and Nehemiah also planned. Nehemiah also planned. This chapter in Nehemiah shows that Nehemiah had been doing a lot of advanced thinking and planning when it came to God's work. When the king asked him in chapter 2, verse 6, how long, Nehemiah, are you going to be away for? What was Nehemiah's response? Well, give me a moment. I need to go talk to my Lord about this. Or, king, I'm not really sure, but if you just let me go, I'll figure it out along the way. Was that his response? No, he gave him a definite time, the Bible says, and we learn later in chapter 5 that he was there in Jerusalem for 12 years. Not only did Nehemiah give a definite time, but he also laid out some definite requisites that show that he did some serious planning. Look at verses 7 and 8 again with me in Nehemiah chapter 2. He said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they may permit me to pass through till I've come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel which pertain to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy." So he had all this arranged. He knew what he needed. He knew where he needed to go to get it. He made plans, and he's doing God's work. Should we be laying serious plans for God's work? Certainly we should. But sometimes we feel that praying and planning are at odds with each other. These are diametrically opposed to each other. Prayer and planning are never at odds with each other. Never. Many Christians think that it's unspiritual to have plans. They say, "Oh, well, just trust the Lord. Just trust the Lord," which being interpreted means I have no idea or any clue about how we're going to get from here to here. We're just going to trust the Lord. Now, it's true. It's true. Listen carefully. I haven't finished my thought. We can go to the other extreme of being so elaborate in our plans that we trust in our plans rather than the Lord. You understand? There's a balance in here that we need to seek for and search. But Nehemiah reveals the biblical balance of waiting on God in prayer, but also thinking and planning about what he would do when God would open up that door of opportunity for him. Nehemiah did not depend upon uncertainty. Nehemiah did not depend upon uncertainty. Sometimes we tend to do that. I want to read to you just a fascinating paragraph from Prophets and Kings, page 633. Listen to this. God's children are not only to pray in faith like Nehemiah did, but to work with diligent and provident care. They encounter many difficulties and often hinder the working. Listen, they encounter many difficulties and often hinder the working of providence in their behalf. Why? Because they regard prudence and painstaking effort as having little to do with religion. Nehemiah did not regard his duty done when he had wept and prayed before the Lord. He united his petitions with holy endeavor, putting forth earnest, prayerful efforts for the success of the enterprise in which he was engaged. Careful consideration and well-matured plans are as essential as carrying forward the work forward of sacred enterprises today as in the time of the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls. And so here we are in the last days, and God has called his church, his people, to build up walls. Do you think we need to have plans? Do you think we need to be intentional about what we're doing? How about yourself, your personal ministry, your family? What are your plans for your neighborhood? What are my plans for my neighborhood? How can I share Jesus with them? We need careful consideration of well-matured plans, just like Nehemiah laid as he was preparing to build the walls. And so, while you wait, and while we wait on the Lord, we pray, we learn patience, and we plan, what else do we face when we're building up broken walls? We're waiting upon the Lord. What else do we learn? To be a builder of a broken wall, what do we need to do? Number two, we need to work wisely with people. It's easy to be idealistic about serving God until you meet actual people that you have to work with. Suddenly you realize the truth that was shouted out: I love humanity, it's people I can't stand. Wouldn't life be great if it wasn't for some people? I'm just teasing. But building broken walls involves people. There are a lot of people who give up way too easy because they've never learned to work with people. They're abrasive, perhaps, in their conversations with individuals, or insensitive. And when people resist them, then they get a persecution complex as if it's their fault, not their own. But when we read the story of Nehemiah, Nehemiah was in particular a very sensitive to people, and he responded to them with tact. But when needed, he also confronted with uncompromising strength. There are three types of people that Nehemiah dealt with in chapter 2. The three people are simply these: the unbelievers, the believers, and then the enemies. Those are the three groups of people he had to deal with. First of all, Nehemiah had to work with an unbelieving king, an unbelieving boss, an unbelieving lecturer, a professor in university. He had to deal with an unbelieving king. And this was an especially difficult situation because, remember, it was the king who had previously stopped the working on the wall in Jerusalem. This is the same king. And remember, the decrees of the kings of the Medes and Persians were proverbial about being unchangeable. So now Nehemiah, he wants to convince the Persian king to reverse the policy about Jerusalem. So you can imagine this is not going to be an easy task at all. This is going to be very, very challenging. So how did Nehemiah get the king to help him? How did he do that? Well, as we've seen, he moved the king through private prayer. That's where he started. He moved the king through private prayer. And it's amazing how God will soften hearts of the most difficult people that we spend time asking him to move upon those hearts. It's an amazing thing. So we need to talk to God before we talk to a difficult person. Do you know of any difficult people in your life? Then spend time talking to God about that difficult person. God has a way of touching and moving hearts. What else did Nehemiah do in order to convince the king to let him go? He also, Nehemiah gained the king's respect through his competence on the job. That's what he did. Do you think Nehemiah did a half-hearted work for the king? No, this man was a planner. He executed his plans. He did the best he possibly could for the king. The king's inquiry, you remember the king asked Nehemiah, well, how long is it going to be? What does that betray? It betrays that the king didn't want Nehemiah gone very long. As a matter of fact, go with me to Nehemiah chapter 2. And notice verse 5. Nehemiah said, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah. What was Nehemiah saying? Nehemiah was saying, you know that I've done a good job for you here. You know that I'm trusted. You know that you appreciate my services. And so if you do, then you'll let me go down to Judah. The king didn't want him to go. He said, how long are you going to be gone for? He really appreciated Nehemiah. Nehemiah had a trustworthy character. And his loyalty to the king had been obvious over the time that he'd worked for the king. Every Christian should be a witness on the job first by being Christ-like in character and with competence. And they should make sure those two things are taken care of first before they open their mouth and share Jesus with their co-laborers or their boss. We have to, so just like Nehemiah, gain respect through the competence, through his competence on the job. Another thing that Nehemiah did was he was tactful and he was sensitive in how he spoke to the king. What's tact? Harry Truman said, tact is the ability to step on a man's toes without messing up the shine on his shoes. And that's a good definition, I think. Did you notice what he said to the king? He said, if it pleases the king, we're in verse 5 again, I ask that you send me to Jerusalem, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Did you notice he didn't mention Jerusalem by name? Why? Because in the king, because it's the king, it was the king who said, you can't be building those walls down there in Jerusalem because Jerusalem is a rebellious city. You can read about that back in Ezra. So Nehemiah doesn't mention the city by name. He doesn't want to create unnecessary prejudice initially. He says, let me go down to Judah, to the city of my fathers. And what was his fathers doing down there? Or at least, where were they? They were buried. They were buried down there. Nehemiah referred to the king in personal terms as the place of his father's tomb. And that's a point that any person can relate to, especially the king. Everyone's going to die. Everyone is going to be laid to rest at some point or another. And so Nehemiah talks about the place of his father's tomb, something that the king could relate with. So if you have to speak to an unbelieving boss, if you have to speak to an unbelieving teacher about a difficult subject, think about how they will receive it and then speak in a way that they are certain to identify with it. Tact and be sensitive. And so that's how Nehemiah dealt with an unbelieving king. Nehemiah also had to deal with believers, but these weren't just any believers. These were dejected believers. These were beaten down believers. The Jews believed in God and his covenant promises, at least intellectually, but they lost hope because the enemy would come in and frustrate them. And Artaxerxes had said, you can't build the city. You can't build the wall at all. They lost hope. They tried to rebuild, but they failed. They were likely to resist then this outsider coming in and telling them they needed to try something that they knew that couldn't be done. It's always been done like this. It's impossible, Pastor. Can't do it. Not going to happen. Sometimes we hear those words occasionally, sometimes. They're likely to resist them. Some may not even have seen the need. And others would warn that if you try to rebuild the wall, you're just going to stir up the enemy. They're just going to be mad and they're going to come in and give us problems and we'll never get the job done. So Nehemiah was careful. He was secretive in his preparations once he got to Jerusalem. And the reason he did that is because he anticipated problems. He anticipated that some of the leaders would be a little anxious about his plans and what he was going to propose. So he spent 3 days doing his homework, thinking and praying and studying the situation and figuring out how to present what he wanted to present to them and answering all the objections that he knew that were going to raise. So after that, he called all the Jewish leaders and the people together and he began to state the problem very plainly. Look with me at verse 17. Verse 17. And then I said to them, "You see the distress that we are in, and how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach." How did he win their confidence? It's three simple things. He identified himself with the problem. It wasn't their problem, it was our problem. He didn't stand before them and say, "How on earth did you let the city come to ruins? How did you not build up the walls all this time? 94 years, what's the matter with you people? Let's get the act together. Let's do something here. Well, at least, why don't you do it and I'll tell you how to do it." He said, no. He said, "Let us. You see that we have a problem." It wasn't their problem, it was our problem. He didn't blame them for things, but neither did he gloss over the fact that we have a problem. And then he appealed to a need that they all felt, that we may no longer be a reproach. Do you think the Jews felt that reproach in the eyes of the nations around them? They had an unwalled city and it was a joke to the surrounding nations. They were defenseless. And so Nehemiah reached out and he sought to seek their welfare by understanding the plight they were in. He talked to a need that they all felt. And then he told them how God had favored him by recounting the king's response and all that took place. And what was the response? What was the response? In Prophets and Kings, page 638, his hope, his energy, his enthusiasm, his determination were contagious, inspiring others with the same high courage and lofty purpose. Their instant response was a response of hope. "Let us arise and let's build." They were encouraged because Nehemiah prayed, because Nehemiah planned carefully, because the blessing of God was with Nehemiah. There is an art to working with people and learning to motivate them to accomplish some great things for God. And some leaders, they make mistakes by being people-pleasing politicians. They want everyone's approval, so they tell people what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. But they erode trust because people quickly realize that they manipulate and they don't speak the truth. Other leaders make a mistake by telling it like it is, without sensitivity and without tact, and they don't take time to listen to people and understand where they're at and how they feel about things. And when people react against that type of leadership, the leader labels those people as disobedient, and then they just move on. Nehemiah should teach us to combine wisdom and tact with plain truth. Nehemiah also had to deal with enemies. The third group of people that Nehemiah had to work with was Sanballat, the governor of Samaria to the north, Tobiah, whose name was Jewish, Yah is good, he ruled the Ammonites to the east, and Geshem was the leader of the Arabs to the south. And they all opposed a fortified Jerusalem because it threatened their political positions. They didn't care at all about the plight of the Jews, much let alone about the name of the Lord being exalted in Jerusalem. They just didn't care. So they were very upset and they joined together to ridicule the project and accuse the people of rebellion against the king. They said, what is this thing that you're doing? Will you rebel against the king? But what did Nehemiah say? And Nehemiah demonstrates both wisdom and courage in dealing with these enemies. He was wise in the sense that he said, look, there's no time for diplomacy. I need to meet these enemies head on, frontal assault. At meeting to hear the concerns or to work out a compromise, that's not going to happen right here. So Nehemiah, he courageously confronted them and he drew a line between them and the people of God, so telling them they could not come over and help with the project because he knew they were going to threaten to sabotage the work. He didn't use, interestingly, the king's letters and say, I have permission to be here. Instead, what did he say in verse 20? He said, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. You know, anytime God's people say, let us arise and let us build, the enemy will say, let us arise and stop them. That's what the enemy does. Someone wrote, there is no winning without working and warring. There is no opportunity without opposition. So a godly leader, and God's people must have discernment to know when to work with people and how to confront and oppose them. As someone wisely said, you've got to decide when you want to give blood and when you don't, you see. And so Nehemiah wisely worked with people. And then lastly, to be wall builders, we need to wait patiently on God. To be wall builders, we need to work wisely with people. What else do we have to face as we build up broken down walls? To be a builder of a broken down wall, what else do we need to do? We need to willingly wrestle with problems. Anytime you try to do anything significant for God, there are problems. The enemy will see to that. We've already seen how Nehemiah dealt with the problems of the enemy surrounding them. And by the way, when we get to chapter 4 and chapter 6, we'll deal more in particular with how to face the enemy's attacks. And we'll look at that together very carefully. But Nehemiah not only had to face the problem of the people, the enemies, he had to face the problem of a broken down wall. There was a logistical issue. He didn't begin by saying that to discover whose fault it was that the walls were still down. He didn't become a part of the problem by complaining about it without providing any reasonable solutions. He began with a realistic first-hand appraisal of the situation. And in one place, as we read earlier, the rubble was so high that he's riding on that mule, he couldn't get by, so he had to turn back and go the other way. As the leader, he needed to know exactly how bad things were so he could develop a realistic, practical plan of action. You can't make a proper plan without understanding a legitimate problem and situation. And so he describes it to the people as a bad situation. And as we'll see the next time, he broke down the problem in manageable units in order to get the job of repairing the wall done. So how do you face problems when they come? Do you face them bravely, wisely? Are you praying when those problems come? So to be a wall builder, just to recap, because I want to remind us today, wall builders are needed more today than at any other time in Earth's history. Society's walls are broken down. Homes' walls are broken down. God's truth has fallen into the streets. So what does it take to be a wall builder? We must wait patiently upon God. We must work wisely with all sorts of people. And we must be willing to wrestle with problems. Just because God is on our side doesn't mean that everything's going to work out smoothly and effortlessly. We need to both have the idealism of what God wants done and the realism of what the major hurdles are to overcome those things and a faith to claim God's promises to overcome those hurdles. What do you say? I want you to think with me for just a moment. Remember that God had a plan. He knew what was coming. The rebellion occurred in heaven, and then that rebel angel came down here to planet Earth, and he just turned everything upside down. The devil came and he began to break down and tear down the walls here on planet Earth. But God had a plan. It was called the Council of Peace, and they came up with a plan. They arose. The Godhead rose, and they worked to build up broken down humanity. God had a plan, and he sent his son. And in sending his son to live the perfect life, to die on Calvary's cross, to rise again, to give power and grace to his people, God has given us the solution to to fixing the broken walls that are around us, the broken walls even perhaps in our homes, even in our personal lives. God is a great builder, a great fixer-upper. And if we give Him our lives, if we give Him our all, He'll fix those things for us. God saw a problem. He had a plan. He initiated that plan. And by God's grace, we accept that plan. We call it the plan of salvation, don't we? It's called the plan of salvation for a reason, because it is a plan. And if we accept God's plan of salvation, He'll build our lives up. He'll restore those broken down walls. He's asking us, you and me, His last day people, to arise and to build. The walls are broken down in society. The walls are broken down in families. The walls are broken down even in God's beloved church. Will you arise and will you build? Will you arise and will you build? Some of you have heard the little saying, and we're going to have it up on the screen here for you. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. I hope and pray that each one of us will put our hand to do the will of God and His work, and that we will know the joy and the pleasure of wall building for God, which involves waiting patiently on God, wisely working with people, and a willingness to wrestle with problems. May God help us in our endeavor is my prayer. God bless you. Short but sweet. Let's pray together. Oh Lord, the song is very clear. The song encourages us. It's a prayer that, Lord, You will help us rise up. This is the day, this is the hour in which You're calling upon Your people to rise and build. It's true there will be some problems along the way. It's true that we'll meet some challenging people along the way. And it's true that we will have to at times wait patiently upon You. Oh, but Lord, give us the encouragement, give us the strength. Help us, help our energies not to wane. Oh, Lord, may we trust in Your promises. Help us to rise and to build up Your spiritual house here on earth, to rise and to build up this local congregation and this church. Oh, Lord, this is the time for us not to be discouraged. It's not the time for us to quit. It's a time for us to trust You, to look to You, to rise and to build. Help us, O Lord, I pray, to do that in our personal lives. Allow You to build up the broken down walls in our families, to do that here in our church, and to allow us to be a part of repairing broken walls in our society. O Lord, thank You for giving us that privilege. Thank You for helping us. We praise You. We thank You. In Christ's name, we ask all these things. Amen.